Welcome to Signs of Life, exploring survival of consciousness, brought to you by the Forever Family Foundation on the web at www.foreverfamilyfoundation.org.
I can feel you like an ocean that won't seem to let me go.
And blessings to all. Welcome to Signs of Life, brought to you by Forever Family Foundation with our host, Bob Ginsberg. I'm Fran Ginsberg, and our show tonight is sponsored by the Winbridge Institute for Applied Research in Human Potential, and they can be found on the web at winbridge.org. Our guest tonight is Dr. Iman Sparush, and if you have a question, comment, or would like to talk to our guest, the toll-free number is 888-627-6008. And good evening, Bob. What's new with you?
Hello, Fran. And, you know, I was thinking about that debate that we watched last night all day today. I don't know if our listeners got a chance to see it, but there was a debate held by, I think the organization is called Intelligence Square, right?
Yeah.
Okay. And the debate, I know this debate was also simulcast live on the internet and on NPR radio. And the topic was the proposition of the debate was that death is not final. And there were two teams, one team arguing for the proposition that death is not final was Evan Alexander and Raymond Moody. And on the other side was a physicist whose name escapes me, Sean something, and a Dr. Novella, who's a neurologist. And it was so intriguing for me because, you know, what happens in these debates is that each side presents, you know, evidence and arguments. And it's very much what we do, you know, as a foundation. I mean, we present the evidence. We don't present, you know, try to convince anybody, but let people make their own decisions, which is essentially what happens in this debate. The audience members were asked to vote about whether they believed that death was not final at the beginning of the debate, and then at the end of the debate, they were asked again to vote to see if who changed their mind, and the one who had the most votes of changing from one side to the other won the debate. In this particular case, the skeptical side won the debate.
So therefore, there is no afterlife.
Well, yeah. But, you know, in watching it, and look, we've seen, I know you've seen it because I've seen it, every time there's a dialogue or there's a debate with somebody that does not believe in non-local consciousness, the argument that the skeptic always uses, and they used it again and again last night, is just simply by making statements that there has never been any credible evidence that the brain and consciousness are not the same thing, or that non-local consciousness exists. In other words, you know, telepathy doesn't exist, and distant healing,
yet they couldn't offer an explanation for what it was.
No.
They just kept saying over and over, it doesn't exist.
Yeah.
It's not recognized by the scientific.
Right. And what I would hope, I mean, what I would have hoped for is that you really have to realize this going in. So the only way that you can refute that is by citing the evidence that it does exist, you know. And I was hoping that the team of, you know, of Evan and Moody would mention things. Are you aware of the decade of research at the Pear Lab at Princeton? Are you familiar with the Ryan Research Center's, you know, work? Are you familiar with the Stargate project of remote viewing that the CIA endorsed? And how about Dean Radin's work, you know?
Right. But here's the problem with the debate. If you And we don't know the circumstances by which Eben and Raymond were chosen to be on that panel, but they clearly are not seasoned debaters. The two of them are speakers. They go around speaking their same story over and over and over again. I would even venture to guess they don't have time to brief themselves on the latest stuff that's out there. You know, they just go out there, and that's how they earn a living, is by being a paid speaker here and a paid speaker there. And so when they're on a panel to debate, they're not seasoned debaters. Debaters know how to debate. They know, they do their research. They have their key things that they're going to throw at the other side, that they know the other side. They know, you know, it's like a good lawyer knows the answer to the question before he asks it.
Yeah.
A good debater does too.
Right.
That wasn't happening.
Well, I agree to a certain extent. I know that, you know, Eben, you know, did get in some good points and did cite, you know, always tried to cite some of the research. But, of course, most of his talk was on his, you know, personal experience. And it's
right.
Very compelling. But, you know, you can't cite these experiences against these skeptical scientists.
Right, because their answer is just, wow, that's a great experience, but experiences are not science. And that was their valid argument, which made them win.
Right.
Is that, you know, you could have everybody in the audience stand up and give an experience. It wasn't going to convince these guys because it's an experience, your own story. Why do I even want to believe it?
Yeah, and I'm not sure that, you know, Dr. Moody was the right fit for that, you know, because he is a philosopher, but he doesn't care much for the science. I think, you know, he stated that, really. I may be mistaken, but I think he made a statement regarding calling parapsychologists pseudoscientists.
You know? Oh, you're not making a
mistake. Yeah, I did hear that.
Did.
Yeah.
He did. So he clearly, you
yeah.
know.
Right. So, you know, he was attacking it from a totally, you know, different point of view. But, the results were, I think, at the end, 5% moved from the death is not... from the death is final to the not final side, but unfortunately 13% went the other way, you know, based on they switched and said,
yeah,
well, they believe the scientific evidence. And that's, you know, it's unfortunate, but that's not unexpected, you know.
Yeah, but see, I go back to the same thing. Neither of the debating partners had a passion for the debate. And even Raymond Moody, I think on two occasions during the debate, said something that was supportive of the other side. And in fact, one of them responded with, hey, why don't you come over here and support
right.
us?
Right.
So, you know, these clearly were not the two that should have been chosen.
Yeah, and when you say it doesn't have, I mean, Eben certainly has a great deal of passion, but it's passion based upon
passion,
his experience. Not,
yes,
not the
an NGE, not a passion for life after death, necessarily.
I think he does
He does, and he does believe in it.
Yeah.
But the passion to deliver his side of the debate, I'm saying that he does...
Debate.
Yeah, passion for debate. You
right.
have, in order to be a good debater, you have to have passion for debate.
Right. Yeah. And not everybody is... I mean, it doesn't matter how brilliant you are or how
right.
deep your experience. There's a technique and an art to debate.
Absolutely.
One which I'm not familiar with, and I don't know how well I would certainly do, so I don't judge anybody. But I've seen, you know, the people that were on the other side were appeared to be excellent debaters. So.
Right, yeah. And they've done it before, you could tell.
Yeah. So, I don't know, do you think that... I mean, it still was a pretty even split when you just look at the numbers even before and after in terms
it was
of
pretty close.
People that believe in an afterlife.
Right, because what you didn't mention was there was a group of people, you know, you didn't have to vote one way or the other. You could have remained undecided.
Undecided.
And it was a huge amount of people that were
right.
Undecided.
There were a huge number of people, and I think that's reflective of society. You know, I think everybody in that undecided category, if you broke it down further, they would say they hope, you know, that they hope there's an afterlife, you know.
I think even the guys opposed to it were hoping.
Yeah. You know, absolutely. I think we all, you know, have that hope. It's just, where do you go from there? Do you turn that hope you know, into a deep belief and eventually into a knowing.
I think you need motivation for that, too, and that usually comes with a personal loss, unfortunately.
Yeah. Well, we're going to go to a break.
So when we come back, we'll hear more about the unseen world from our guest tonight, Dr. Iman Sparush.
It is with great pleasure that we announce the formation of the Winbridge Institute for Applied Research in Human Potential. Dr. Julie Beischel, Director of Research at Winbridge and one of the premier investigators in the field of mediumship research, reports that the team at Winbridge will continue pursuing the many unanswered questions that remain in the field of afterlife science. Please go to www.windbridge.org to learn more about this groundbreaking research institute. That's www.windbridge.org.
Hello, my name is Lauren Halpern, and I'm a Reiki master. I enjoy bringing peace and inspiration to people. I conduct healing circles with inspiration, meditation, and Reiki at different community developments, religious institutions, and many other locations. People react so wonderfully to my events. For more information, please contact me, Reiki Touch by Lauren at 954-464-0087. That's 954-464-0087, or email me at laurenhalpern@gmail.com. laurenhalpern@gmail.com.
Hello, my name's Piero Calvi Parisetti, MD. I invite you to discover my video course on Evidence for Life After Life, a professional counseling resource for the bereaved and the dying.
Transform the fear of death. Heal the pain of a loss by learning about life after life.
For more information and a free preview, visit www.drparisetti.com. That's drparisetti in one word.
I would like to introduce you to the Forever Family Foundation, a nonprofit organization whose mission is to provide a forum where individuals and families who have suffered the loss of a loved one can turn for support, information, and hope. We believe in the continuity of the family, even though a member has left the physical world. The Forever Family Foundation is a joint effort of scientists, research mediums, and interested people who support the premise that life does not end with physical death. We wish to prove that the bond of the family cannot be broken even by death. We invite anyone who's trying to cope with the loss of a loved one to contact the Forever Family Foundation at 631-425-7707. That's 631-425-7707. Or you can find us on the web at foreverfamilyfoundation.org.
Welcome back to Signs of Life, brought to you by the Forever Family Foundation.
Just tuning in, our guest tonight is Dr. Iman Sparush. Our sponsor is the Winbridge Institute for Applied Research in Human Potential, and they can be found on the web at windbridge.org. Bob?
And Dr. Iman Sparush is a professor of psychology at the King's University College at the University of Western Ontario. Although his background is very diverse, since 2004 he's been teaching courses only about consciousness and altered states of consciousness. Dr. Barush has authored or co-authored 5 books, his latest being The Impossible Happens, A Scientist's Personal Discovery of the Extraordinary Nature of Reality. He's written a great many papers. They've been published in psychology, philosophy, anthropology, mathematics, cosmology, consciousness studies, and science journals. He served in a number of administrative roles, including chair of the Department of Psychology and member of the Senate of the University of Western Ontario. He belongs to many professional organizations, including the Society for Scientific Exploration, the New York Academy of Sciences, and the Society for Consciousness Studies, which he co-founded. The website is barusss.ca. And welcome to the show, Iman.
Well, thanks. It's wonderful to be here.
I mentioned briefly that, you received your master's degree in mathematics. And when I saw that, I started to wonder, you know, how you made the switch. And you answered that, or why you would make that direction shift right off in the prologue of your book, because you wrote that you knew for a long time that there's something inherently mesmerizing, I like the way you put it, about the subject matter of consciousness, particularly when you take anomalous phenomena into account. So I guess the question is, so what is it that makes these unseen energies or unseen realms so interesting to you and to so many other people?
All I can say is that from the time I was a child, it was something that interested me. And when I was old enough to go to the library by myself, I would take the streetcar and go to the library, and I'd head straight to the supernatural section. And I took out every book that they had, pretty much, and read them. And so by the time I was, 8, 9, 10 years old, I knew all about poltergeist phenomena and those sorts of things. I think from a more professional or scientific point of view, I think that what's important about phenomena like that, about what we would call anomalous phenomena, is that they really show us the cracks in the way in which we think we understand reality. And it's important to pay attention to those cracks, because those cracks can open us up into new ways of understanding things that we didn't have before.
You interact with your students on a daily basis, and I saw something on your website where you said that the students are seldom convinced by the scientific evidence, and they often tell you that they'll believe that something actually occurs when they experience it for themselves. So, do you think that personal experience is the only pathway to move one into this knowing category, or can one achieve this knowing by becoming familiar with research?
Well, I think you're asking a very good question. I think that one can become familiar with this kind of material by studying the scientific research if one has a disciplined mind. If one is able to think logically and to look carefully at the empirical evidence. But very few people actually are able to do that, including scientists. There's a whole host of defensive maneuvers that we use psychologically to protect ourselves from information that we don't want to hear. And scientists are as good as anybody at using those. And so they tend to push away things that they don't want to think about, they want to hear, that interfere with their career path, that aren't part of the way you're supposed to think about things, and so on and so forth. So I think that, and one of the things we don't do when we train scientists is we don't train them to learn to cope with those defense mechanisms. And so most people, including scientists, aren't able to remain neutral and to just look at things very clearly, very logically, and look at the evidence clearly and logically, and then say, what does the evidence tell me? Where does the evidence lead me? And let that be where they go. So when you don't have that, then you need the experiences. And so somebody who's had a near-death experience, many people have had near-death experiences, they come back, they're not the same. And I've talked to people like that, some of my students, for example, and they're not the same. They're different. They realize that they've been missing out on something, and now they feel they see something in a way they didn't before. So having experiences is a way of helping to see what's going on in reality.
Now, and in your own case, obviously, you're an accomplished scientist, but you also have had an abundance of personal experiences. So, I mean, when you think about the survival hypothesis, had you not had all of these personal experiences yourself, do you think that you would feel the same way towards survival? Would you be leaning in that direction or perhaps not?
I think most of my leaning is on the basis of the empirical evidence.
Okay.
You have to understand that the empirical evidence for survival is very complicated, and it requires a lot of thinking and deep philosophical arguments and so on in order to actually make one's way through it. But on balance, and I think I say this in the book, on balance, having looked at that evidence, the evidence I find, you know, I think tips in favor of survival. In terms of the personal experiences that I've had, I mean, my own inclination is to tend to be a pessimist. I mean, you know, why should good things happen, you know? It's just my natural tendency. So, you know, all kinds of interesting things have happened to me, but I go like, and does that actually prove anything? You know,
yeah.
So my mind just starts chewing on it and sort of dissecting it and analyzing it and looking for any problems with it, and there it goes, you know.
Well, that's the way it should be. I mean, I think we should all be open-minded skeptics, and who better than you to question your own personal experiences, you know, because you've had the scientific training. You know, much of your book centers around your own significant dreams, and you mentioned the term, you know, dream architect. Can you tell us a little bit more about that term? What does it signify?
I'm not the only one who uses the term dream architect. Lots of other people use it, and basically what we mean by that is whatever the psychological process is that organizes the dreams. The content of the dreams, their pacing, the color, you know, or whatever might the dream might be like. So, and, you know, and then, you know, it's an open question. Like, so is that a part of your psyche always? Is that someone else? I mean, one of the things that occurs frequently for people who have lost someone they love is they will see that person in their dreams, and then they go, wait a minute. Is this an actual encounter? Did I actually meet that person in my dream? So in that case, the dream architect is organizing some kind of meeting with someone else who might be showing up. I mean, if you want to think about it that way.
Yeah.
So dream architect is basically just whatever those psychological processes are that organize the dream in the way that it is. And the contents could be coming either from the psyche or they could be coming from outside the psyche.
Mm. So a dream architect, you might say, you know, could be the universe at play, or it could be a form of your higher self, or in what you just mentioned, if you have a dream visit, so to speak, of somebody of a discarnate, the dream architect could be that discarnate entity, couldn't it be, other than some other outside force?
I think that there's going to be, I mean, there has to be some kind of interaction between a person's psyche and whatever is coming into the psyche. I mean, that's the way it seems to me. So there will always be a dream architect, which is part of the psyche.
Okay.
But yes, I think that somebody else could sort of, or some other outside influence or whatever, could organize a dream. You get this with people with DID, dissociative identity disorder, where different alters apparently have the ability to prepare and present dreams to other alters, which is a very strange kind of thing to think about.
Mm.
And those alters sometimes might be disembodied beings showing up using that body, if you want to think about it in those terms.
And I have to admit, you had some you know, amazing dreams, but I'd read through the dreams, and then I'd say to myself, okay, you know, how is Dr. Baruch going to interpret these to make them to be some sort of a meaningful blueprint for him to take action, you know, because to me, as I read them, I really couldn't make any sense of them. Then I would read your interpretation, and then I would say, wow, that makes a lot of sense. So, you know, how does one get to that point? I take it, it must take quite a while to be able to interpret your own dreams, no?
Years of trial and error.
Mm.
I think Douglas Baker said at one point that it takes about 2 decades to establish, the way he put it was, to establish a typewriter with the subconscious. In other words, to figure out what the symbols are, how it's acting, the ways in which it shows up, the ways in which it doesn't show up, and so on. I think, and I'm not sure, I think that for each person will find his or her own way to figure out how their dreams mean something. And it doesn't have to take 20 years. The only other thing I really want to say about this is that one of the things that I learned over many years of thinking about dreams, looking at other people's dreams and looking at my own, is the degree to which dreams will conform to what you expect they will do. So if you think that a certain thing, like in my case, I think that lottery dreams are about publishing papers and books. So because I think that, the dream architect knows that. So the dream architect picks up on that and goes, oh, okay, well, let's just... And it can be something whimsical. I mean, the psyche, like the deep psyche, or however you want to talk about it, the higher self or whatever terms you want to use, is playful. And it seems to have its own sort of way of doing things, which is more allegorical, mythological, narrative, not logical, you know, like not like, you know, predicate calculus sort of stuff.
Right.
So learning how that part sort of plays with you and how to interact with it, I think is what the trick is.
Mm.
Because it's not, it's often not, I mean, sometimes it's straightforward. I'll give you an example if you want. Waking dream. Okay, so I think waking dreams are important, so maybe that's why they're important. And as I'm in my waking dream, I'm in a health food store and I'm looking for selenium, and the word selenium is written on the wall in front of me in the store, and somebody is chanting the word selenium, 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 selenium. So when I wake up, the word selenium, 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 selenium is going through my head, right? So I go, okay, selenium. What about it? I didn't know anything about it, or pretty much nothing. I knew it was some kind of mineral or something. A couple days later, I got a hair analysis back. One of my former students is a naturopath now, or doctor of natural medicine. It turns out that the levels of silver in my body were 22,000 times higher than normal. And it turns out that selenium is used for chelating silver out of the body. So in this case, there's no subtlety, there's no representation, nothing. It's just straight like being whacked over the head with it.
Mm.
But that doesn't always happen, and I don't know why. And this is what I mean. It's like playing with that inner deep part, which has its own way of doing things, and sometimes will come across like that and often won't. And that's true, by the way, of people who've done studies looking at precognitive dreams, and there's a breakdown. Some are literal, many aren't. Many are representational. Mine tend to be representational or symbolic rather than literal.
Yeah. And you mentioned waking dreams, and I know that you did write in the book that you feel that those are the most important ones. So any theories as to why that waking state of consciousness is it seems to be more significant than a dream that you might have, let's say, earlier in sleep?
I don't know. I think that one of the things that some people will tell you, like Elmer and Alice Green, for example, did a lot of research on theta brainwave activity. And they said that, you know, whenever your brain goes into that kind of theta state, it's like a gateway to the sort of gateway to other realms, or to allows you to access other dimensions or parts of your psyche. And so I think, you know, as you're going into sleep and coming back out of it, you're sort of between like the kind of the delta. And then while in REM sleep, of course, you're in sort of very fast, sawtooth sort of wave kind of brain waves. But there could be something about that liminal state. You're not quite there. You're not quite here.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, that tipping point. I mean, there are meditations that are done in some traditions on the setting sun or on the rising sun, because that transition point is like a crack between worlds, and it gives you access somehow to other states. So, I mean, I don't have a good answer for that, but I think that there could be something having to do with that you're sort of neither here nor there at that point. There's some kind of, and that introduces a flexibility or a pliability in your psyche that whatever is impressing you, whether it's your higher self or some deeper part of your psyche or someone from outside the psyche who wants to let you know something's happening, it might be the opportune point at which to do it.
Mm. So you'd probably advise people that want to work with their dreams and learn to pay attention and interpret, to possibly put more significance to a dream that they had just before they woke up.
Well, I think they can try doing that, sure. But they might find that, and I think that there are a lot of individual differences, if they believe that, you know, it's going to be in the middle of the night, or they believe that it's going to be somewhere else, then that could very well end up being where they get their information. So, you know, I mean, because as I said, one of the things that has really, in some sense, surprised me is the extent to which the dreams will respond to what you think they are doing. So if you think your dreams are meaningless, you will have really juicy, meaningless dreams.
Right. So you mentioned that a lot of your dreams were precognitive. So when you have a precognitive dream, do you sometimes try to change the outcome of what you envisioned in your dream?
Oh, yeah, especially if it's something I don't want.
Right.
Like, so if it's a disease, or if it's there's a car crash, and so you go, oh, no, something's going to go, you know, wacky. I mean, I don't need that.
Right.
So then you look at it and you try to understand, so what is that? What is the dream telling me? What is it that's coming? What's going to show up? And how do I navigate that? And one of the things that's interesting about dreams, and this is something that Carl Jung also noted, that dreams usually already contain the solution. So if you see the problem, there's often also the solution presented in the dream. So you can sort of look to see, well, where are my sort of reference points, or where am I getting help, you know, in this dream? Like, where is it coming from? Is it coming from the person standing next to me? Is it coming from the natural world or an animal or whatever it is that's in the dream that could be a source of trying to help you to change a situation you don't want? And if it's
right.
changing, and if it's a situation I want, then it's like, oh, please let me not screw it up.
Yeah.
So that it actually happens.
Right. So, you know, people probably make a mistake by if they have something precognitive by thinking that it's etched in stone and there's nothing that they can do to change it. You know, I mean, certainly free will plays a part.
I would agree with that.
Yeah.
I would also say that the extent to which you can change something, I think, depends on practice. Because I think at one point, like, it's almost like at one point, you see something happening, and you go, well, how can I change it? And then it's like trying to run away from something, and by running away, you actually make it happen. You know, like, and so, oh, geez, here it was. Like, I was trying to run away from it, and then that made it happen. So, you know, geez, I can't run away from my destiny. You know, like that kind of thinking.
Yeah.
But, and so, I mean, I think that figuring out how to create those changes and then making them happen, I think, is something that one can learn to do. And I think that there can be an increasing amount or increasing degree of control over what will happen.
Mm. We're going to go to a break. When we come back, I'd like to get into a little bit of some of your other work, you know, with healing, and I know you've experimented with EVP and some personally, you had some past life regression and things of that nature. So we're going to come back when in about a couple of minutes. We're going to go to a break, and stay with us, and we'll have more with Dr. Baruch, the author of The Impossible Happens.
It is with great pleasure that we announce the formation of the Wimbridge Institute for Applied Research in Human Potential. Dr. Julie Beischel, Director of Research at Wimbridge and one of the premier investigators in the field of mediumship research, reports that the team at Wimbridge will continue pursuing the many unanswered questions that remain in the field of afterlife science. Please go to www.windbridge.org to learn more about this groundbreaking research institute. That's www.windbridge.org.
The American Association of Electronic Voice Phenomena has always been international and concerned with more than just EVP. To better serve the public, the AAEVP is now Association Transcommunication, or ATRANSC. Their new website is ATRANSC.org, and their motto is Objective Evidence of Survival. The directors believe people should know that death is not dying, and what we learn now applies to what we will learn hereafter.
The Camlack Center is putting birth and death back together again. Aimed at changing the way we look at death, the Camlack Center was founded in 2002 as a publishing company and teaching center. When we know that there is nothing but life, we realize that birth and death are events in time and space. Our grief can open us to other dimensions of reality and allow us to experience our loved ones who are no longer in the physical body. Our events and products are based on personal experiences of survival of consciousness after physical death and decades of research into how death has influenced the development of our consciousness. Visit www.camlack.com, that's K-A-M-L-A-K.com, for articles, videos, books, and more to help you cope with the loss of a loved one.
For years, people have been reporting communication from those no longer in our physical world. Historically, science and religion have taught us to ignore such messages. Yet, there is now substantial scientific evidence to the contrary. In response to this, the Forever Family Foundation has developed a sign registry to demonstrate the existence of this other dimension. On our website, people can register signs that they, after passing, plan on communicating to a specific loved one. Upon the registrant's passing, the stored information can be verified by the recipient of these signs. Participants will be taking part not only in a grand scientific experiment, but in providing the greatest gift of all, the knowledge that we survive our physical death. For more information, contact the Forever Family Foundation at 631-425-7707, or you can find us on the web at foreverfamilyfoundation.org. Or to register a sign, go directly to thesignregistry.com.
Welcome back to Signs of Life, brought to you by the Forever Family Foundation.
Just tuning in, our guest tonight is Dr. Iman Sparush. Our sponsor is the Wimbridge Institute for Applied Research in Human Potential, and they can be found on the web at windbridge.org. If you're a business interested in advertising on our show, please contact us via email at radio@foreverfamilyfoundation.org or call the office at 631-425-7707. Before we get back to the show, it's time for some foundation updates for our listeners. Did you know that you can financially support the work of Forever Family Foundation, a 100% not-for-profit organization, without sending us a single pretty penny? When shopping on the internet, think of us before you go to Amazon.com and instead go to foreverfamilyfoundation.org and use the Amazon link to get to Amazon. Don't worry, there's a link on every page of our website. If you add that one simple step to your shopping, a dollar percentage of everything that goes into your shopping cart will generate a donation from Amazon to us. And what if you don't shop on Amazon? That's not a problem. There's another way to be certain that almost all of your website shopping produces a donation to Forever Family Foundation without you having to send us anything. Visit iGive.com. Sign up. It's free. Name Forever Family Foundation as the charity of your choice. And just like with Amazon, a portion of your spending results in a donation to Forever Family Foundation. Once you set it up, each time you shop on the Internet, iGive.com will automatically send us a donation when you shop in one of their more than 1,400 online stores that you're probably already shopping in, like L.L. Bean, Home Depot, J. Crew, or even The Body Shop. And one last thing, you'll need a credit card to shop online. So if you don't already have one or need another, go to foreverfamilyfoundation.org and apply for the Visa credit card. Visa will make a donation to us for each card that's taken out. And each time the card is used, a portion of that charge is donated back to Forever Family Foundation. So please take a few moments when you shop to show us that you care. Our annual grief retreat is set for the weekend of July 25th to 27th back at the wonderful Guest House in Chester, Connecticut. We've also added one day just for parents who have lost children. Details are all up on the website, and it is a very special weekend of a small group of like-minded people sharing a very special journey. So if you want to be part of this, make your arrangements early. You do not want to miss out on this meaningful experience. And if you'd like to save some money, we could put you into a double or triple room with other attendees of the same gender. Reservations can be made via the event page on our website at foreverfamilyfoundation.org. And many of our listeners already know that March marked our 10th year as a 501c3 not-for-profit organization, serving the world in our mission to prove that life continues even after the physical body dies. In celebration of this event, we're revisiting our very first event from 2004 with a 10-year update on the current research that supports the existence of the afterlife. Please join us on July 29th at Long Island University, where Dr. Piero Calvi Parisetti will present The Afterlife, A Scientist's View, and will be followed by a demonstration of spirit communication for those in attendance by Forever Family Foundation certified medium, Laura Lynn Jackson. And lastly, save the week of November 6th through 11th for our annual Afterlife Conference and Convention. This will be a big one, and you don't want to miss out on all the pomp and circumstance. Back to you, Bob.
And we're back with Dr. Iman Zbarush. The book is called The Impossible Happens, A Scientist's Personal Discovery of the Extraordinary Nature of Reality. Iman, I wanted to be sure I mention something that you wrote in the book. Well, you were discussing remote healing, and you wrote something about the process that appears to be related to all of psi phenomena, that we should get out of the way so that a deeper process can be initiated. So do you think it's a mistake that people seem to often try to force intention or force healing or even force spirit communication? It seems that it doesn't happen that way, does it?
Well, you're asking another really good question. Certainly, I think that there are different types of remote healing or remote influencing. Some of those depend upon processes in which a person uses very deliberate volitional actions to try to create a particular outcome. And I think some people can get really good at those. I'm thinking of Tomas in South America, who appears to be able to create all kinds of physical phenomena at will.
Mm.
But I think that the more expedient route, so to speak, is to establish a link and then get out of the way and allow whatever that deeper intelligence is that has the ability to create change to do what it needs to do. I mean, that's sort of how I'm starting to think about it. I mean, not that, you know, that's a radical way of thinking about it, but
yeah,
you know, like just from my experience and from talking to people and from what I've heard and thought about these things, like that seems to be sort of what's happening. So it's you're not pushing and pulling, you know.
Right.
And as soon as you start pushing and pulling, you've lost it. And what you need to do is you just need to sort of relax back into a more neutral space, and then, you know, just sort of have the clarity of mind to understand or feel that there could be something deeper, which is at work.
Mm. From reading about your own research and your own personal experiences, I learned that apparently a healer may actually take on the illness that they're trying to heal in others. I mean, is that something that you found to be true? I think you called it tracking. Is that something that happens often?
I think there's a difference between tracking and taking on someone else's illness.
Okay.
Tracking, and I mean, mediums will often experience it. The more a medium sort of is a physical manifestation medium, the deeper she allows whatever it is that's influencing her to get into her physical body, so to speak, the more she can experience things in her body that whatever it is trying to show or you know, point out or whatever. And so the tracking is sort of just like resonating, or it's like being a mirror and mirroring in your body and in your life what it is that's going on for someone else. The whole idea of taking on someone else's disease, first of all, I'm not sure that it happens. I think it's probably likely, given, you know, all the other really strange things that can happen.
Mm.
It seems to be sort of crossing another barrier. And I've had two people confidentially tell me about situations in which they very explicitly and with a great deal of intention, well, in one case where someone asked to take someone else's illness and then suddenly had it, and in another case where someone healed someone and had the exact illness that she had healed the other person of, and because they're confidential, I can't really say much more than that.
Right.
And so what I'm interested in is knowing if there are other cases like that out there, and then to sort of analyze those cases and see what happens. It's possible. I mean, that's about all I can say.
Yeah. Well, I know that you went into some pretty interesting details about your own health crisis, and you were working with a healer. And what I found a bit fascinating is that at one point, she had put her hands on strategic areas of your body, and then you described feeling a vibration. But then you saw your abdomen actually collapse about 1 to 1.5 inches. So when you later asked the healer about that occurrence, she told you that a pattern of information had left. What do you think she meant by that, as a pattern of information?
Well, I think that if you think about this the other way around, like if you don't think the physical body houses, you know, or creates consciousness and so on and so forth, if you think about it the other way around, like consciousness creates the physical body,
right?
Say, like, or the mind creates the physical body. Like if you think about it sort of like a top-down kind of version, then you go, okay, so something is holding the physical body in place the way it is. And so there are these patterns of information in your body, and one pattern of information could be a particular disease, another one could be an organ, another one could be, you know, a digestive process, or whatever. I don't know what they are, but whatever they are, it's like there's a whole bunch of them. So what if you can go back to that level where those patterns are and just say, well, let me move this one. I don't want it here. I just want it somewhere else, wherever. It can go wherever it wants. And it's just suddenly gone. And if it's gone, then the physical body, because it's just a reflection of whatever that deeper patterning is, has to respond. It doesn't have a choice, because that's all it is. It's just a sort of an outpouring, or it's a projection of whatever that is that's inside. Mm. And so, I mean, I think, and that's also how you can understand this sort of why you could, you know, a disease from one person could migrate into someone else, or why you can have these. I mean, you just mentioned Tomas. I mean, one of Tomas's tricks, and he's followed around by all these, like, lawyers and doctors and military personnel and so on, watching him do these things, is to take the 5-peso note or whatever it is that they use in that country. Somebody cuts it into 4 pieces and holds it in the palm of his or her hand. Not his hand, but their hand. And then he does his thing, and they open it up, and it's intact again. It's not cut up anymore, but the pieces are in the wrong order. So if you think, okay, well, that's a nice story, except that he appears to have done this a lot of times, and a lot of people are carrying these around as souvenirs. So how do you do that? Like, what does that tell you about what reality must be like? So if you can reorganize it that way, then maybe you can reorganize it in the physical body as well. And mm-hmm. and that could explain some of these sort of spontaneous healing, some of the cases where, you know, somebody has, there's something there, and then the next day it's gone, you know, that sort of thing.
Mm. It's an interesting concept. Do you think a lot of people talk about, quantum entanglement and quantum science and how in the microscopic world, our observations, collapse, waves into existence. Do you think that may be true on the macro level, that we can maybe move these patterns of information based upon new observation? Does it work that way?
Well, I think that's one way of trying to explain it, is to go to quantum theory and try to do it that way. I mean, I've written, I think, 4 or 5 papers about that sort of thing, trying to link quantum theory with, how maybe these kinds of things could happen.
Yeah.
One of the things, like a very simple concept in quantum theory, is that physical manifestation is in a state of superposition. That means that there is no single determined physical state until you actually choose what you're going to measure. Or some people say it's because of decoherence caused by background radiation and so on, but there are other people who say that I can't possibly explain all of how you get rid of all the superposed states. But anyway, so you've got a state of superposition where all these different realities exist, and you're continuously selecting one or another one of them. And that's one way of thinking about how you could sort of radically jump from one version of physical reality to another one, is you're simply selecting another one of those superposed states.
Mm. I know we're reaching the end of our time, but I wanted to just briefly mention past life regression. I know that you've personally been regressed a bunch of times. I was always somewhat skeptical of past life regression due to the fact that, it takes place in a hypnotic state. One's very susceptible to suggestion. Although, the evidence that I've seen sometimes can be very compelling. So what are your thoughts on regression?
I think that a lot of, first of all, you don't need hypnosis to do it. You can just get someone to go through a guided imagery exercise. And hypnosis is just a guided imagery exercise. It's called hypnosis. So it's, that's not to say that there isn't an altered state that some people can go into, which we identify as hypnosis, but I don't really have time to get into that.
No.
But with regard to the past life regression, I think a lot of it is projection. Like, I think that people, it's like the dream architect, right?
Yeah.
Same psychological capacity, probably. You go, okay, I'm going to be regressed into this past. So you create a past that mirrors what it is that you're dealing with. And that's helpful to you because you go, oh, look, I was, X, Y, and Z in past life. And that explains why, and then you work with those images. And when you start working with those images, see, as soon as you start working with something, even if symbolically, you cause shifts in the psyche, or you can cause shifts in physical manifestation by working with them.
Mm.
So it doesn't really matter if it's a real past life or not.
Yeah, well, we could do a whole show on that.
Yes, we could. But having said that, I think that there is too much evidence for the idea that we really did also live before. I mean, if we're going to live again in some form or other, then we probably lived before in some form or other.
Yeah.
And so that's not such a strange notion, I think.
No, it's not. And we have been talking with Dr. Raymond Baruch. The book is called The Impossible Happens, A Scientist's Personal Discovery of the Extraordinary Nature of Reality. Website is baruss.ca. And you will find on our website an Amazon link to the book. Iman, thank you so much. We enjoyed it. I hope that we'll be able to continue this conversation in the future if you join us again. There's so much more to talk about.
It was a pleasure.
And thank you so much.
You're welcome.
We now ask our listeners to please join us in our Healing Energy Circle prayer. May the universe create a channel of healing energy from our participating listeners, sending that energy to those who are in need of recovery of the physical body, spirit, and mind, as we visualize the healing light upon David Mello, Henry Stark, Johnny Jackson, Andy O'Brien, Tanya Cash, Stanley Mullen, Glenna Irwin, Lynn Austin, Michael Tim, Patty Potter, Eileen Lafata, Wendy Lippo, Barbara Russell, Tim Donahue, Phil McKee, Gina Donato, Ann Hutchinson, Kimberly Saavedra, Rachel Skandarian, Jeanette Davies, Miriam Pierzga, Julie B., Christina D. Donato, Barbara Patillo, David Haith, Rita Springer, Mark Barron, Vicki Steffi, Tom Donahue, Jean Lash, Tracy Lee Nash, and Rita Dwyer. Now let us, as one consciousness, give our energy of loving thought by praying like this: to love one another, to treat others as we would like to be treated, to forgive others and return love for hate, kindness for anger, to spread this feeling to everyone, to our fellow man, as well as the earth and its environment. And now it's time for us to say,
our loved ones are only a heartbeat away,
and science is going to prove it.
Good night, everyone.